Hello and a very warm welcome to you if you've just tuned in or logged on. I'm Jenny Devitt and this is Countryside Matters, your weekly programme on things to do with the outdoors. We certainly don't need reminding that it's been a very wet autumn so far, not to mention rather gloomy. But it has been mild, so that combination of higher than usual temperatures and lots of moisture has been very good news for fungi, because there have been lots popping up all over the place. Mycologist Dr. Rowena Hill has some fascinating things to tell us about these strange organisms, starting with an explanation as to what exactly they are.
Fungi are a whole kingdom of life. So in the same way that plants and animals are kingdoms of life, bacteria too, fungi are their own kingdom. And it actually used to be thought that fungi were more closely related to plants or were a kind of plant. But these days we actually know that fungi are more closely related, if anything, to the animal kingdom than the plant kingdom. And part of that is that fungi can't photosynthesize in the way plants do. They can't create energy from the sun. Like us, they have to eat things, basically.
So what we see above ground, those are the fruiting bodies of the organism underground.
Absolutely, yeah. So that mushroom, or as you say, that bracket fungus on a tree or something that you see, when you're on a walk in the woods, that is actually, yeah, just the reproductive structure or fruiting body, as you say. So it's, yeah, analogous to the fruit of a plant. But actually, the mycelium, which is sort of a massive network of fungal material, is out of sight underground or inside a log. And that's there all the time. And it's just every so often the fungus will realise it's a good time to reproduce and produce the actual mushroom or fruiting body.
And if we, Rowena, if we were to dig down into the soil below that, would we be able to see those tiny filaments, those mycelia?
Yes, so you can. I mean, they're really sort of tiny, microscopic. Generally, if you're wanting to look at mycelium in the lab, you are using like a microscope. But they are like sort of tiny, almost root-like, very fragile structures. And they can spread over a huge area under the ground, for instance. Fungi that are associated with tree roots, which are known as mycorrhizal fungi, they can form actually like a massive network that is in association with all of the tree roots.
That's a mutual dependency for food, isn't it?
Exactly, yeah. It's what we call a symbiosis. So the fungus helps the plant uptake water and nutrients, and in return the plant is giving the fungus carbon. And that's like a stable interaction that they have where they're trading goods, basically.
And I'm wondering, what might the health of the tree be like if there weren't those little filaments, those mycelia?
That's a great question. I mean, I think it's over 80% of plant species are associated with mycorrhizal fungi. So it's clearly pretty essential for, plants as we know them. And actually the formation of these symbiotic interactions between fungi and plants was probably an essential part of the evolution of plants to this day. So there are a few plants that we don't know to have mycorrhizal associations, although they may do, we just haven't spotted them yet. But presumably it's basically essential for plants to thrive.
And I guess that would explain why it's often so difficult if you're trying to relocate a plant or a tree to get them to grow successfully if you don't have those fungal filaments.
Yeah, absolutely. I think very much in the same way as how we're realising how important, for instance, the gut microbiome is to, our human health, and we really didn't appreciate how important microbes were. I think it's very much the same for plants. Yeah, there's this whole invisible element happening, not just fungi, also bacteria. And it's not always, or it's not ever just an individual species as well. It'll be a whole community of microbes that are associated with a plant. And that's, inside them, on the outside of them, in the roots, in the leaves. And that all of that has evolved for success of the plant.
There's another very interesting thing about those underground filaments, isn't there? Am I right in thinking that according to what a number of people have said, those filaments actually in a wood provide a means of communication between trees?
Well, this is actually a little bit of a contentious debate at the moment. So that has been very much something that's been sort of reported in the news and sort of communicated to the public, that there's this, what is often referred to as a wood wide web, and that these mycorrhizal fungi under the trees can actually sort of connect different individual trees and help them, yeah, send chemical signals as a way of communicating. And this has actually been suggested as a way that, for instance, a parent tree can preferentially send things to offspring to help them survive. But actually now there's quite a lot of debate in the science community about really if we have the evidence to say that. I would say probably a healthy bit of skepticism about that exact model is probably for the best, because basically, you know, it doesn't quite fit in with our understanding of how the natural world works, that something would just sort of do something for nothing, basically. And in that scenario, the fungus, what's it getting out of just sort of out of the good of its heart helping these trees? And really, it's probably much more of a scenario where it's more of a free market, you know, free market economics under the ground. And a fungus will choose sometimes to trade and help a plant, but other times it will hold back because it might not be in its best interest. And so I think that the wood wide web concept is undergoing sort of a lot of scrutiny at the moment.
So we need to remain sceptical about that one, do we?
Yeah, exactly. Just in the way that sort of we do, you know, for everything we read, it's and also science moves on, you know, and we learn more and we adapt our understanding of things as we get more evidence.
I'm wondering, Rowena, since we always associate fungi with damp, what happens in dry climates? Do you still find the same symbiotic relationships between plants and fungi?
Well, that's a good question about I don't know about the distribution of mycorrhizal fungi, yeah, in drier places, although I'm sure they are there too. But certainly there are fungi that are adapted to drier conditions. Some can produce a special kind of spore that is very resistant, you know, to being desiccated for a long period of time. And I mean, there's a famous sort of fungal species at the moment in the deserts of the west coast of America that actually causes valley fever. So this is a microscopic fungus that is, you know, in the desert sands and soils. And it can hang around there for ages until there's a tiny bit of rain, and then it can cause a real outbreak of this valley fever disease in humans.
Does that actually produce a visible fruiting body above ground?
No, yeah, that will be, it will produce reproductive structures, but I'm pretty sure they'll be microscopic as well. So you wouldn't see, yeah, the mushroom.
Fungi in the desert then. Now, why is it, seems an obvious question, but why is it that autumn is the best time of year to see lots of fungi? Because it's generally so damp?
Yeah, so rainfall, wet conditions are one of the sort of biggest factors for a lot of fungi. Nobody will have failed to notice, I don't think, that we had, you know, an incredibly wet start to this year, and then it sort of continued really through the summer. And both having lots of water around and also certain mild temperatures are often the ideal conditions for fungi to start forming. So autumn in our temperate northern hemisphere, autumn tends to be the best time for both temperature and rainfall for a lot of fungi. And basically that's because, well, of two things really, which is that the mycelium under the ground is there all the time, and it just wants to pick one best moment to produce its reproductive structure to disperse its spores. And basically when you have that little proto mushroom that starts to form, when it gets triggered because of the wet, it has everything inside it sort of ready to go. And it actually gets bigger by just taking up loads of water, and that actually allows it to expand into its final big mushroom form. And then it releases the spores, and spore germination is really aided by wet conditions too. So it's just a perfect melting pot of conditions in the autumn.
Seeing as it looks as if climate change is going to send us a lot more of this sort of weather, can we expect to see an explosion of fungi around us?
I mean, unfortunately, with the projected milder, wetter winters for us in the UK, and, you know, we've been getting very wet summers sometimes too, haven't we? It will favour a lot of fungi. And unfortunately, there are lots of neutral fungi that are neutral to us, you know, as humans, and fungi that are beneficial even. But there are the pathogens, things that cause disease in humans, or things that cause disease in our crops. And yeah, we're really looking at climate change favouring those in the future, and it is likely we'll get worse disease outbreaks in the future with climate change as conditions.
Are you looking into this at the Earlham Institute where you work?
So my work is mostly to do with fungi that are associated with plants, so both crops and their wild relatives. So I am interested in these questions of what makes one fungus harmful and another beneficial to a plant, so that we can hopefully, you know, help protect our crop plants and protect food security. For the climate change question, I think it's something that all scientists have on their mind at all times. And, you know, knowing that these crop diseases are going to only get worse in the future, it's certainly something that feeds into the motivation to do my work.
In your article, you expressed a word of caution. You said that we should be extremely careful about mushroom and fungi identification books, since some are now being written by AI and can't be trusted. So how do you find reliable sources of information so you don't go and poison yourself by eating the wrong thing?
Yeah, absolutely. And I'll just say that, yeah, unless you're 100% sure, you should never sort of chance it with trying to pick edible mushrooms. But there are some great sources out there. There's a lot of established books. I think that my best recommendation would be pick a book that you can see has had many, many editions, you know, over 100 years, because they're out there, books that were first published decades ago and then have had many updated editions since then by like well-known publishers. That is should definitely be a reputable source of information.
And of course, with good photographs?
Yes, good images and then just as much, you know, information as possible. And it's funny because there are things you might not think of that can really tell you a lot about whether or not a fungus is edible. So actually smell is a really big one, the descriptions of what it should smell like. And that can be the difference for some species in sort of knowing what it is or not.
Finally, Rowena, in your article, you give what to me is the very surprising fact that fungi don't just like rain, they can make it.
Yeah, absolutely. This is a really fascinating one, I think. So essentially, when the way that our clouds form and then form rain is the fact that there's tiny particles in the atmosphere. And a lot of these are, they can be not organic particles necessarily, but they can also be pollen. Pollen's a large part of it. And essentially, these tiny particles provide a surface on which the moisture in the air can sort of be attracted and form a water droplet. And then you have that happen millions of times and it forms a cloud. And actually, fungal spores, when they're released by the mushroom into the atmosphere, can be the surface on which these droplets form. So actually, I think this is, you know, really understudied. The extent to which this is happening is really underappreciated. But, you know, if you have a rainforest and the part of the cycle of that rainforest is, you know, continuous cloud formation and rainfall, actually the fungi releasing the spores in that forest can be contributing to that cycle, you know, keeping that cycle going.
Dr. Rowena Hill, who's a postdoctoral researcher in mycology at the Earlham Institute in Norwich.